Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the first August edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, broadcasting here on Premier Christian Radio and all over the world via our podcast. Great to have you with us for another conversation that matters today, discussing biblical womanhood, and I'll introduce both my guests in just a moment. Just a couple of things to let you know about on the Unbelievable front. We have a new place that we're putting out blogs now, responses to past shows and that kind of thing. You can find it at premierinsight.org/Unbelievable. And if you're listening to the podcast, you can find a link with today's show in the info. We've been publishing also some clips from our Big Conversation series. Those are available via our website and articles as well. If you want to keep abreast, though, of all things Unbelievable, do get our newsletter. That's a really easy way to get in your inbox all the stuff that you want. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for links to the newsletter, today's show, everything else. And of course, again, if you're listening via podcast, it's all with the info on today's show. Let's get into today's program.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we've got an egalitarian and complementarian perspective discussing biblical womanhood. Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller are joining me. What is the biblical womanhood movement, and is it actually biblical? Today's show features this egalitarian and complementarian perspective from Beth and Rachel. Beth Allison Barr is Professor of Church History and Associate Dean of Graduate Studies at Baylor University. Now, her book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood, How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth, has been causing quite a stir in evangelical circles recently. My other guest, Rachel Green Miller, is co-host of the Theology Gals podcast and author of another book, Beyond Authority and Submission, Women and Men in Marriage, Church and Society. So today we'll be exploring both the common ground between both my guests in terms of what they see as perhaps the excesses of this biblical womanhood movement, but also their differences when it comes to Beth's egalitarian view and Rachel's complementarian view on the roles of men and women in the family and church. So really looking forward to today's discussion. Let's first of all introduce Beth to the show, and welcome, Beth. Congratulations on this new book. I hear it's been selling very well, and lots of invitations like this to appear on podcasts and such like.
Yes, thank you. I'm not sure if I feel very congratulatory today. You know,
it why? Is. Why? What's happened? You had a bad day?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure what happened. People are reading, and that's very good, I guess. There's a lot of people are reading, and people are thinking and provoking conversations. So those are what you want as an author.
Yes, though I can imagine it comes with a fair amount of pressure and pylons on social media, I'm sure, occasionally.
It does, yeah. And the hard part about it is that I'm a full-time dean. So, you know, that's like really my side gig. So when you add that to everything else I do, you know, it's a lot.
Well, tell us a bit about the book, because it tells your own story as much as obviously the story of biblical womanhood. Maybe start there. What sort of church environment did you grow up in when it came to male and female roles?
Right. So I grew up Baptist, Southern Baptist, and my husband, I married a Southern Baptist pastor, and he went to a Southern Baptist seminary at the height of Paige Patterson's reign at Southeastern Baptist while I was in a medieval studies program at Chapel Hill and women's history at Chapel Hill. So it was quite an interesting, you know, our graduate school experience was really, you know, different in what we were doing. And we've always been in more conservative evangelical churches. My husband had been in several different positions, mostly as a youth pastor over the, in North Carolina as well as in Texas. And this book is not something I ever intended to write. I keep saying that. I don't know if people believe me or not, but I never intended to write this book. This book was really an act of desperation. At a moment where I just thought something has to change. I was like, I know all of this stuff about the history of where the concept of biblical womanhood came from, and nobody in my church knows it. And nobody, this matters in the lives of women. And of course, the triggering for it was when my husband was fired from a position we'd been in. The triggering factor for it was us asking for a woman to co-teach a Sunday school class of high school kids. Right. And that led to him being fired. Within 3 weeks of us doing that, he was fired. Lots of things going on in that, but that was the triggering factor for it. And when I sort of recovered myself and started moving forward, I realized that I just couldn't let the status quo stay anymore. And I started writing on my blog post on the Anxious Bench. I started a series on, my first one was on Paul. I was like, there are different ways to read. There are different ways to read Paul and still be a faithful Christian. And so that was really my first series. And then I started a series on patriarchy called Disrupting Christian Patriarchy. And that was the one that I guess sort of got me into the business of writing this book. That got the attention of an editor. And they reached out and asked me to write the book.
Well, we'll get into the book in a moment's time itself and the history of what you call biblical womanhood and find out exactly what that is as well. Let's introduce Rachel to the show first of all, though. Rachel, welcome along. Would you give us a little bit of your background as well? Was it at all similar to Beth's? What brought about the inspiration for your own book?
I also grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. My dad was ordained as a Southern Baptist pastor. He was at Southwest Seminary when I was a child. In the mid-90s, he switched to becoming a PCA pastor, Presbyterian Church in America. And so we moved with him. So I went into the PCA then and was in the PCA for 25 years. And we've been in OPC the last two, mainly for the church was very close to us. Like they moved down 10 minutes down the road. And it was just a great fit for our family. Honestly, in my own family background and my own church background, I did not experience a lot of the patriarchy that I write about. My mom is a professor. My parents both recently retired. My mom generally earned the lion's share of the money in the house through her job, which allowed my dad to be a pastor as he was called to do. And, there was never any question growing up about women being restricted from, like, roles in society or, getting education. A lot of the things that I talk about were not my own experience. It wasn't until I got into homeschooling, I homeschooled my boys, that I got into a different world of thought. And I kept coming across these ideas, and I was trying to figure out where they were coming from and what the common themes were. And my own educational background, I have a BA in history, and I focused on medieval history. It was my favorite part. But the things that I was reading about, things I was hearing about, these views about men and women sounded very familiar to me. And it sparked memories from classes that I had taken. And so I went and started looking at researching what was being taught kind of commonly in very conservative circles, what the themes were, and I realized that they were similar to things that came out of the Victorian era. They were similar to ancient, like Greek and Roman pagan thoughts about men and women. And so the idea for me in writing the book was to take those ideas and trace them kind of through those periods, like the Greek and Roman ideas how it shows up again in the Victorian era as kind of a baptizing of these ideas. And then how in the, you know, modern era of complementarianism, starting around the 1980s, in response to, say, the sexual revolution and the feminist movement, second wave, that there were these ideas that came up and they were looking back to these older Victorian and pagan ideas and saying, this is what it means to be biblical. And so it was tracing that and then wanting to look at those and compare that to what Scripture teaches and see how we can move kind of away from this hyper-focus on authority and submission and these views about men and women and go back to Scripture so that we have healthier churches, healthier families, healthier environments for us to be in.
Yeah. And to that extent, even though you do ultimately fall in different places theologically on the issues around men and women in, you know, family and church, nevertheless, there is that overlap between both your books in terms of what, you know, you would see as the excesses and the things that are actually cultural baggage, Rachel, when it comes rather than biblically based. And obviously, Beth, you've done a lot of work on tracing the history of this movement yourself. Give us a sort of, you know, whistle stop tour, if you would, Beth. I mean, firstly, what is biblical womanhood? How would you define that? And what does it look like today? Does it bear any relation to the way it has looked or the way men and women's roles in the church have been viewed in previous ages?
Sure. And this might be a point, too, after I define biblical womanhood that Rachel might want to define, because she might differ with me on the definition of what it is. So as a historian, I really see that biblical womanhood is what I call patriarchy. And patriarchy is a system in which women are always under the authority of men, and that they are always in legal, economic, religious, you know, family, whatever, that they are always under the authority, under masculine authority, and also limited by what they can do by the male jobs and roles around them. So biblical womanhood, however, it fits into this framework of patriarchy. But it's a very modern manifestation of it, and Rachel is spot on that a lot of what we have today was born in the 19th century. And a lot of what we know happens in scholarship, a lot of the scholars of the 19th century were actually looking back to the Greco-Roman world. And so we see a lot of those classical ideas come back up in the 19th century. And the idea really, and even, you know, a lot of it is from the Scientific Revolution as well. But biblical womanhood is essentially the idea that women and men are equal before God, but different in their roles, and that women are called to, you know, I put it very shortly, women are called to follow and men are called to lead. And that you also see with, and there's different variations of biblical womanhood. You know, some women, it really is more just this overarching structure, whereas they might not be pastors or leaders in their church, and they might be, you know, technically under the authority of their husbands in their home, but yet there's a lot of, they still work outside the home, and they still may bring in the highest paycheck, et cetera. Whereas there are other forms of biblical womanhood in which women are restricted from even doing those things, and that women are discouraged from working outside the home. And this was actually something that I began to encounter significantly in the early 2000s when I began to have children. There was a lot of pressure put on me to quit my job as a professor and stay home. And so this was coming up even in what I would have considered to be a broader complementarianism at the time that was becoming more and more rigid.
Before we come back to Rachel, maybe talk a bit about some of these modern manifestations, some of the people who have been pushing this more kind of rigid, as you say, form of complementarianism. The people may have come across the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Yes. What do they say? What's the kind of line that they hold on these kinds of issues?
Yeah, no, this is great. So this is one of those things, the pieces that I started putting together. And of course, I kind of grew up during this time that complementarianism is hardening. And so, like, I don't really remember it being a big deal when I was a child in the 80s. It may have also just been my age. James Dobson was all around everywhere, and we were listening to James Dobson. But it was really in the late 80s and early 90s that we begin to see some of these ideas begin to emerge that really begin to emphasize women in the home and men as the leaders. And then in the late 90s, you know, and of course, part of this, too, is the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood formed in 1987, I think it was 87, 86 or 87. And this is with Wayne Grudem and with John Piper and with, you know, those are some of the big names associated with the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. We also have Denny Burke, who is now part of it, as well as Al Mohler. And so they, and sort of the idea that that came together, the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood was a reaction against second, really third wave feminism. And this was, you know, in the 60s and 70s, this push for women to be able to work, and that really the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, also, you know, in part of this too was the push to have childcare. For state-sponsored child care so that women actually could work outside the home. And there was a very conservative reaction to this. You can think about Phyllis Schlafly, who led the charge against the ERA, and et cetera. And so there began to be a lot of rhetoric emerging in conservative Christian households that to be a Christian family, to be a stable Christian family. And this also fed into James Dobson, you know, focus on the family. The idea was to build a solid, stable family where your children become devout Christians and they stay true to the faith. And so how do you do this? You do this by teaching what it means to be a man and to be a woman. And so the argument was, is that, you know, women need to embrace this role of being caretakers of the home and being caretakers of the family. And, you know, they don't need to put their children in state-sponsored daycare where who knows whatever is teaching them, but they need to be the primary influence on them in the home. And so it was also wrapped up, I mean, biblical womanhood has been wrapped up in politics from the very beginning. And that's something, right, too, we don't really like, yeah, to think about.
Yeah. Rachel, coming to you, do you hold a similar kind of view of the way things have emerged and the description there of biblical womanhood that Beth gives?
Certainly. I think Beth's right on about the history, the movements that influenced how we got to where we are today. I would think that, or I think that there's a place to differentiate between, I guess, what would you call it, the kind of the classical complementarianism, and you mentioned hard complementarianism or strict complementarianism. I think that there are a lot of people who consider themselves complementarian, and what they really mean by it is they think that, you know, husbands should be leaders in the home and wives should submit to that leadership, and that only qualified men should be ordained in the church. But they don't really see it going much beyond that, like in their day-to-day life and in how they view things. The biblical womanhood, biblical manhood, the complementarianism as a movement that starts with CBMW in 87 and with Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood as the book in, I think, 91 is when it's published. Those essays really define the movement. And a lot of what you see today as kind of the strict or hardening of these ideas are all there in seed form. It was there from the beginning. Truthfully, I don't use the term complementarian for my own position,
okay,
because of all the baggage that it's taken, because of everything else around it that it gets attached to it. It's just not worth explaining, well, I'm a complementarian, but I'm not that kind of complementarian because of the discussions in the last couple of years. What I see, especially with biblical manhood and womanhood, is it's become, or, you know, with CBMW, with Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, it is about ontology. It is about the nature of men and women, not simply about, you know, in marriage, what do each spouse do because husband and wives have different callings, or in the church, you know, who does scripture say should be ordained? It's about men are supposed to be a certain way, women are supposed to be a certain way, and they're defined as opposites in their very nature. So you see, and Beth mentioned a little of it, the men are strong. These are the leaders, the providers, protectors. Women are soft, so they're submissive helpers, keepers of the home. And And that ontology, those, that idea about nature becomes then kind of the grounding of all of the rest of it. So if women are naturally submissive and helpers, then it's against a woman's nature to be a CEO, for example, right? And so, or, you know, you have John Piper's essays on, you know, trying to figure out if a job is too much outside the nature of a woman to do, like a drill sergeant or umpire at a game, right? These are discussions that they get into. Or even, you know, just if a man is supposed to be a leader because by nature he is strong and a leader, then, you know, in the workforce, if you have a man who's working for a woman, then you have to figure out how he's supposed to lead her, but from a submissive position, and how she's supposed to submit to his leadership. And it takes this incredible gymnastics to try to work through these ideas. And part of why I got into writing about men and women and the church and the home and society was because I'm hearing from women saying, how do I do this? What is it okay if I make more money than my husband? Or a discussion that I saw on a board, should men tell their wives how to vote if they're allowed to vote anyway? Right? These kinds of things. And it's shocking in a way, because you think, how are we in this day and age arguing about whether it's okay for women to vote? But this view comes up, and this view about who men and women are in their nature, and that gets applied to the Trinity and a whole mess that creates. It gets applied to all sorts of, like, should brothers be leading their sisters? Like, it's a mess, because we've taken these categories that I don't believe are biblical and trying to force people into them.
Yeah. I mean, to that extent, you as much as you, and I, again, I'm using the label that you don't particularly like anyway, complementarian there, Rachel, but as someone who does hold, if you like, to a more traditional understanding, let's say, of the roles of men and women in the home, the family and the church, you think that there's this overreach when suddenly it's all women should be in submission to all men, as though there's some kind of general category, and that simply is not what the Bible teaches as far as you're concerned. Very interesting. Right. I mean, feminism, let's talk about that, because you said, Beth, that's partly this particular version of biblical womanhood has been partly in response to that. I mean, and perhaps Rachel can comment on this as well. Do you call yourself a feminist, Beth? And I mean, is that a title that Rachel would be happy to hold? And again, does it depend what kind of feminist? You know, that I guess it's always and very often feminism has become a boogeyman in certain evangelical circles, because it's seen as somehow contravening the sort of a God-given sort of perspective on men and women and their roles. So Beth, maybe start with us on what the issues are around feminism.
Yeah, I'm a very happy feminist in the sense that I believe that women are created completely equally to men, and they can do, you know, that they can do their callings. Their sex does not limit our role and what we do in the world, and that women should be able to make equal pay for equal jobs and should have equal opportunities for men, and that women should not have to be dependent upon male authority, you know, in their lives. Like, for example, I talked to my students about, you know, as late as the 70s and early 80s, single women would have to get male co-signers to buy a car in the U.S. I mean, which is crazy. And thinking things like that. And so, you know, feminism is simply this concept that women are people too, and that women are completely as human as men are, and should be treated that way. And like anything else, there's various manifestations of feminism. I know as a historian that by using the feminist label that I am also showing my class and my race. It is a white, mostly a white woman label. You know, this is developed among educated white women. Think about the suffrage movement in the late 19th century, which is the beginning of what we would consider to be modern-day feminism. And, of course, modern-day feminism is sort of this awakeness that there are structural things within our society that make women subordinate to men, and that in order to, for women to have equality, we have to address those structural problems within society. There's a lot of people upset about structural problems within society today. Think about all the CRT conversations. But that's essentially, so that's why people also don't like feminism, because it says there's a structural problem in our world that subordinates women to men. If I was a black woman, and thinking the same way that I do now, or thinking similar to what I do now, I'd be a womanist, and so we have to think about too, about our labels also show, they show more about us, you know, like about our culture. I mean, they are culturally constructed, and even labels like feminist are culturally constructed.
What do you do with the label feminist, Rachel? Is that one you're happy to wear or not so much?
Similarly to not, you know, liking to use the term complementarian for myself. I don't take the term feminist to describe my views because of the baggage around it, especially in conservative circles and trying to understand and explain, well, I'm feminist, but I don't mean that, because it's used as a term to shut down discussion in conservative circles. So you're labeled a feminist. That means if you're a feminist, then you have to be pro-abortion. You have to be pro this, that, and the other that we disagree with, and therefore you're bad, therefore you're evil, therefore I don't have to talk to you. Like, it's, you know, I like to say that, you know, feminism has an actual meaning, and it doesn't just mean you're a woman I disagree with and I want you to stop talking, because that's the way it's used, you know. So, I mean, as Beth talked about the different waves, I absolutely agree with the aims of first wave feminism. Yes, there were structural problems. There still are structural problems that need to be addressed. In one section of my book, I talk about in the beginning of the second wave with the 60s and the 70s, and even into the 80s, and the way women were treated in the workforce. You know, my mother got her first job in 1969, 1970 as a programmer. And the things that they were allowed to ask at the time, ask you things like when your last period was, trying to find out if you're pregnant, because they won't hire you if you're pregnant. Getting passed over for jobs because, well, that man who you trained has a family that he needs to support. Like, mom's like, well, so do I. You know, these kinds of things, not be able to get education, not be able to get a credit card or credit in your own name, banking accounts, finances. All of these were things that are absolutely necessary for us to address as inequalities. So where I deviate at, a lot of what's become tied up when the sexual revolution and abortion and these ideas that became associated publicly or in popular culture with feminism, I don't agree with them. I don't want to be included with that. And so I find it easier just to talk about what I think is appropriate, or, you know, the equality I think that women should be treated with without taking the label. It's interesting, Beth, I wanted to comment where you said that feminism and feminist becomes, you know, kind of a, you know, white women of a certain class. Right. Biblical womanhood is the same way. The only people who can possibly hope to achieve this ideal are women with enough money to be able to have this discussion. Right. You know, when your main concerns are, do we have enough food on the table? Do we have shelter? Do we have clothing on our backs? Which is most of the world through most of history. Everybody's doing whatever they can to contribute to that. And so these discussions about, you know, should women only work from the home? It's very modern, and it's very elite.
I would agree with that.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. We're just approaching our first break, folks, so we'll take a quick break and we'll come back. Now, this first section of the show has very much been both of you, you know, giving your critiques of biblical womanhood. But I do want to move on to sort of some of the differences between you as well, because you do land in different places theologically. And perhaps we'll start to open up some of that in the next part of today's show. But we've got two perspectives on biblical womanhood today. Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller join me here on Unbelievable. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I'm joined on the show today by Beth Alison Barr and Rachel Green Miller. We're talking about biblical womanhood. That's the subject of Beth Alison Barr's recent book. It's called The Making of Biblical Womanhood: How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth. I'll make sure there are links to both my guests from today's show and where you can find their books. Rachel Green Miller's book is Beyond Authority and Submission: Women and Men in Marriage, Church and Society. And as I mentioned, up to this point, there's been a lot of agreement between you both in some of the excesses of the complementarian movement and biblical womanhood and so on. But it would be interesting to sketch out some of the differences that you nevertheless both have. Broadly speaking, using a very broad brush here, Beth, an egalitarian, what's often called egalitarian perspective, Rachel, more complementarian, though obviously that comes with a certain amount of baggage, as we've said. Let's talk about that. Maybe, Beth, start just quickly, define what you would see an egalitarian view as, and Beth, and Rachel, then maybe what your view is, at least as far as you might call it complementarian. But let's start with Beth.
Yeah, I think probably the main two differences when you think about egalitarian, or another term is mutuality, people, you know, mutual, women and men work together, is really on the issue of, is there male headship in the home and in the church? And I would argue that there is nothing about a man that makes them naturally have headship over a woman, and that the Bible actually doesn't teach that. I would argue that that's not, that we have read that into the Bible, and that that's actually not what's being taught by the Bible. So I would argue that while I do, that women can be pastors, that women can be preachers, that women can be ordained. I use the word ordained with caution because it's also a historical word. You know, I could tell you an ordination, ordination has a history. And so it's funny when people draw the line at ordination to me, because I'm like, well, you know, ordination isn't really biblical. I mean, I guess that there's a biblical basis to it, but what we've done with ordination, it's like the role of senior pastor. I mean, there's no senior pastors in the first century church. So, I mean, thinking about those things. So I would argue that whatever the leadership positions are in a church, whatever your culture is, that women, that there are no limits on women being able to hold those. And I think probably the best summary of my position is actually quoting Dorothy L. Sayers, who's one of my favorite theologians and mystery writers. She writes some great detective novels, and but also she's a theologian. And she has this great response to C.S. Lewis, who wanted her to help him support women not being ordained in the Anglican Church. And she wrote him back, and she said, you know, I'm paraphrasing. She said, you know, I just can't do that. Because even though it might make sense in like a play, she was also a playwright. She says, even though it might make sense in a play to cast Jesus in the part of a man, because Jesus was a man, she said, which would, you know, put the priest at the altar. If the priest stands in for Jesus at the altar, then that would be a man. She said, even though I see that that makes sense, she said, Jesus wasn't just for men. Jesus came, and Jesus came through the body of a woman. Both sexes were part of God's salvation plan, and that, you know, that women, that Jesus is, that women are in the image of God just like men. And so she says, I can find no theological or biblical reason for women not to be able to stand at the altar just like men. And so I would stand with Dorothy L. Sayers on that.
Interesting. Thank you. Rachel, maybe define your position and exactly where the boundaries fall for you.
You know, I have kind of a point of, you know, here's what I believe, because because I've been in these discussions so long, I usually have to, you know, clarify where my lines are. But so if you'll bear with me, I believe that God made humans, male and female, in his own image, that in Christ, men and women are equal before God. I believe that men and women are interdependent and should serve each other, that marriage was designed to be between one man and woman, ideally for life. I believe that husbands are called to sacrificial servant leadership of their wives, to love them as Christ loves the church, and that wives are called to yield voluntarily to their husbands, to submit to them as the church submits to Christ, and that only qualified men should be ordained leaders in the church. For my denomination, that's elders and deacons. The reason I put it in that way, especially with called to, is, you know, like we talked about, in the last segment about where complementarianism sees men and women as the nature of men and women is leadership and submission. And, you know, Beth mentions it in what she said about, you know, there's nothing about a man, about a husband's nature that makes him the head. I would agree that it's not an issue of, you know, nature. It's not that he's a man, therefore he's the leader. I'm a woman, therefore I'm a submitter, right? That's, I see, though, in Scripture a call for husbands to lead through service and wives to lead or to submit to that leadership in serving their husbands. Practically, the way that works out, I believe, is ideally both the husband and the wife submitting, serving, loving each other, putting the needs of the other first, working together. You know, I'm not talking about like the tiebreaker argument that's very common that comes up about, well, who's going to make the decisions. I mean, really, if that's, how often does that happen? that's really the, we're going to make a whole theology on this one point. And as far as the church, I think that there are the qualifications for leadership from 1 Timothy 3, and I'm going to blank on the other passage, on Titus, that it's a high bar, that not many are qualified, not many are called to ordination to that kind of leadership. And so then you have the majority of us in the church are laymen and women who should be working together, and that anything that a non-ordained man can do in the church, that women should be doing too. So whatever that looks like in your tradition and your church, it should be, women should be encouraged to participate and to be a part of the life of the church in those ways.
Because, and obviously that perspective is very different to, say, I've even heard of churches where a woman cannot even do the Bible reading from the stage, because that is literally a woman having some teaching authority or some speaking role that isn't. And so for you, Rachel, obviously you see that kind of application of verses like, you know, 1 Timothy 2:11-15 and so on as very outside of what actually the Bible is really teaching on these issues.
Yes. If your church says that, you know, on Sunday from the pulpit, only the elders are to preach, only the elders are to pray for this part of the service, you know, if that's the way you define it, then, you know, I don't have a problem with the elders being the only ones who do those things. It's when you get into things that, well, you know, generally we like the elders to do this, but really any man can do it in a pinch, that I think it undermines what I think the Scriptures teach about ordaining elders. I think it undermines our own arguments for who can do what in the church. I see the line between ordained and not ordained, right? So if you have whatever these things are for us, only the pastor can preach on Sunday, right? So that's something that only he does. But, you know, if you give an announcement, if you have other things where women are leading singing or whatever else it is, that's a leadership, a visible role in the worship. If it's outside of those prescribed ordained roles, then I think anyone should be doing it, as long as they're gifted, as long as they are respectable. Like, you know, you don't want someone who is, you know, notoriously for cheating and lying and stealing being up in front of the church.
Sure.
Taking care. So I think that there's...
Yeah, just be interested in your responses, Beth, to all of that.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking historically here. It's really interesting because what Rachel just described is very similar to medieval Catholicism. I mean, you know, if you think about the medieval, the lines with ordained, that in the medieval church, only men could be ordained. From that, they were technically only the ones that could be priests. And there was a very small amount of them that could do that. But that was really, you know, that was the leadership in the church. Ordinary men didn't have that type of spiritual authority over ordinary women. And so, in fact, you know, ordinary men and women came to the priest as individuals, not as a woman under the headship of her husband coming before the priest. So it's actually kind of interesting to hear Rachel describe that, because that is a, that, you know, that is something that has historical roots. It is also something, of course, though, you know, that I would argue that that understanding of hierarchy in the church and that understanding of ordination is, while I do believe that God calls people to different jobs and that some of those jobs are to be, to lead a church, and I do not think that is a calling that a whole lot of people have. I think we've confused a lot. We think if God calls us, that that's where we're being called to. I think, you know, if we think about Corinthians and Paul's imagery of the body, there's a whole lot of jobs that we should all be doing in the church and working together for the good of the church. And so I think we have way too much emphasis in the modern church on sort of the importance. In fact, as a medieval scholar, I find it really interesting how much weight Protestants put on the authority of their pastor. You know, my husband and I joke, my husband's an ordained pastor, and we joke all the time about how whenever we're at gatherings and so forth, he's the one who's always called on to pray. And what's funny is his sister is also ordained, and they still will call on him over his sister, you know, and it's, anyway, but it's funny. It's sort of like, because he's a pastor, he's more efficacious. And so it's kind of funny that I think we still carry these things when we think about, you know, that even though we resist, we say we all come before God as spiritual equals, there's still something when we start creating these types of hierarchies and ordination and so forth, where we see some people as having more access to God than other people. And so historically and sociologically, I find this fascinating. And I like, you know, it's one of the things that really interests me. I'm also sort of showing that I'm not only for women and men in leadership, but I'm also totally a Baptist. Like, you know, I found as I've gotten the way that I perceive church governance and, you know, congregational, I'm very democratic, I guess, in almost every aspect of my life. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah. I mean, but just to address, you know, the issue you do have ultimately with Rachel's position, is it that you feel that in her denomination, or her particular view on qualified men being ordained, that the gifts of women are being missed out on in those sorts of roles?
I think women are gifted in those types of roles too. I think if we think about the giftings of people in the church, what we see is in the early church, we see the primary roles are, you know, we have the apostles, the disciples, the apostles. We have the deacons, and those are really, you know, the two early, and then we have teacher. Those are really the three primary roles that we see in the early church and that we see Paul talk about. And we also see women serving in all three of those roles. And so it seems to me that even though roles are culturally constructed, you know, like what we call it a pastor today, we've called it priest in the past, you know, we've called some bishop, et cetera, whatever it is, that if you translate that actually to what's going on in the early church, women would have been in those roles too. I don't think women would have been in those roles as often as men are, because patriarchy existed in the first century, and it's always harder for women to do these things. They're always fighting more battles than men are to be able to use their gifts. But then we see in the Bible women doing all of these things. I also think, and this is one of the things that I was kind of trying to get at in my book a little bit, and even though I totally understand where Rachel comes, you know, with, and not just, but also I understand how people come to complementarian or the idea of male headship from biblical readings, and I do see that theology, and I think, in fact, I have argued before that I think women like Rachel and Wendy Alsup and Amy Bird, I think they actually have the most sound theological arguments for male headship, much better than ones I've seen at the CBMW, which aren't really sound arguments. So I would argue that they're making the soundest, and I'm really interested about Amy Bird's book coming out to see, you know, she has this one, and I'm really interested to see what she argues in there. But I would still argue that those passages that we see, that we think about as limiting women's ability to teach, I would say that we really have to understand them within their historical context and what Paul is actually doing in those texts.
Well, let's pass it over to you, Rachel, and just any response to some of those issues. And perhaps if you want to comment on any specific passages, the one I've brought up on my iPhone here is 1 Timothy 2, which is often used, obviously, as a, specifically an injunction against women teaching or having authority over men in a church setting. But go ahead.
Yeah, a couple things. You know, one is, while I do consider it to be a significant difference in understanding, so between my view and Beth's view, significant enough that it would be hard to serve in the same church because we would have different ideas about the leadership and the way it should work, right? But in the same way, it's not an issue that divides us as believers. Like we are all believers. We all have our faith in the same Christ who died for us. Like it's not that kind of a, it's not a first tier disagreement, right? This is not a denial of the Trinity. This is not, you know, a denial of, the divinity of Christ. It's not that level, right? It's second tier, you know, like Beth is a Baptist. I'm a Presbyterian, right? We have differences in our understanding of who and how someone should be baptized. That's a significant difference, you know, and yet we're still believers, right? So these, to kind of put the argument where it is, right, to put it in its right perspective. Because there are many, especially those and on both sides, who would make it more of an issue than I think it needs to be, where they don't have civil discussions anymore about these things. As for the passage, you know, Beth mentioned about hierarchy. I don't like to talk about it. In fact, part of the reason I wrote, called my book Beyond Authority and Submission is that I don't treat it as a hierarchy. Yeah. I think that we can talk about order in the church, order in the home. It's not about who's in charge. It's not about power. I think about the passage when Jesus is talking to the disciples and he says, when I talk about leadership, I'm not talking about you leading like the Gentiles do. We're not lording it over people. And I think there is too much focus on power and status when we talk about marriage, when we talk about the church and leadership, when we should be focused on how to serve, which is what Christ calls us to. I really liked neither egalitarian nor complementarian. I probably got that backwards. It's Michelle Lee Barnwell's book. And she does a great job of talking about servant leadership and what it means and how it works. And her main point is on that is that we seem to take it and say that servant is kind of the qualifier. So you have leaders, but they should be servants. And she's like, it's backwards. We should have servants who lead, right? And I think when we see that, then it's not so much about putting this person in charge so they get the honor and the glory, but it's about being first to serve. And so that the pastors, elders, husbands are called to serve first. Like that is the sacrificial role in what they should be doing. And I recognize that in the church, historically, over time, from the early church, there were more things that women are doing than we have today, right? That there are limits that we've put in place today that I don't think are biblical. But I do think when you look at the passages like 1 Timothy 2, when you look at the qualifications to be an elder, I think that there is good biblical support for limiting who can be ordained. Even when you look at the 12 called disciples, right, for Jesus, they're all male. Even though there were many women who were there, we know that they were there all the time supporting his ministry. Part of it, they were, you know, obviously very well respected in the sense that, you know, they are honored. You see Jesus tells Mary to tell the disciples that he has risen. Like, there's something there that's very special and particular in the relationship with the women that are there, but none of them were disciples. So I also know that we're looking at the same evidence, both sides, we're looking at the same scriptures, the same verses, and we're coming at them legitimately from biblical perspectives, and we're coming to different points of view. And, you know, so I'm not looking at, you know, here I have the silver bullet that's going to prove that my argument is the one. You know, I don't think that way. I'm convinced for mine. I'm willing to discuss it with others, but, you know, I'm not here to shoot down someone else's argument and say,
sure. Response to that, Beth. And again, maybe we can stick with 1 Timothy 2 and 3, as it mentioned. I mean, just for those who don't have a... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about... You know, 1 Timothy 2 is also funny to me, being a medieval scholar, because if you actually applied it to leader, it doesn't work in the medieval church because they're all celibate. They're not, you know, this idea of it being a one, you know, one husband, one wife man. And that's, so, I mean, it's interesting to me that we put a lot more weight on that, you know, that qualifier that, you know, the married man, we put a lot more weight on that qualifier because we put a lot more weight in Protestantism on marriage. And that's actually, you know, one of the central arguments of my book is that we have elevated marriage to a point that has harmed women. And so, so I think, you know, I think it's funny. We have to think about how culturally we view these passages. And I think also one of the things, I'm not a biblical scholar, but I have a lot of biblical scholar friends, and I've had people parse those passages for me and actually sent them, you know, what we know, and Lucy Pepiot does a lovely job. I love Lucy Pepiot. You know, she's a beautiful scholar, and she's also a very kind person. And so she has a lovely, you know, she looks through these passages, and she's like, there's not in the Greek, there's not any, the terms aren't gendered. You know, they actually are, they could mean either men or women. And even, and if we think about, and even that phrase, one, you know, one wife, what is the exact phrase? Is it one wife man? One.
Well, if I read, you're quoting 1 Timothy 3 here. Is that what
I am quoting 1 Timothy 3. I'm sorry. My mind went to 1 Timothy 3 because I was thinking about the qualifications for the elders and so forth.
Just for the sake of, you know, those who don't have a biblical photographic memory, here's some of it at least. So starting at 1 Timothy 2:11, these are often the verses that mm-hmm. are most jarring for many people. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission.
Yep.
I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with propriety. Then into 1 Timothy 3, here is a trustworthy saying, whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him, and he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? And goes on to say mustn't be a recent convert and so on, and then talks about deacons in similar manner. So, and then says in the same way the women are to be worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, temperate, trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be faithful to his wife and so on. So that's often used inevitably as you know, and so Rachel, just firstly, for you overall, that is that kind of where you get the qualified male as the ordained person. But what do you also do with, you know, the first part that I read, which is women should not teach or have authority over a man? That does sound quite general, at least in the way that NIV is translating that. So maybe some commentary on that before Beth comes back in on with her thoughts on this passage.
When I look at that, it's the two things together, teach and exercise authority. So it's a particular teaching authority, not a general teaching. And when that he's talking about, so that's where I would say it's still talking about particular positions of authority in the church that are restricted. Because when you consider the number of places within Scripture where women are, and Paul talks about it, so women, he gives instructions for how they should pray, how they should prophesy, which is they're speaking in church at that point. So there can't be, the passage can't be a complete restriction of women speaking in church, because he talks about women speaking in church. So it has to be something that's more specific to a particular understanding of what he's talking about.
And If I could jump in there, I mean, people have made the same point about 1 Corinthians 14, where there is this passage about women keeping silent in church, yet only earlier on in 1 Corinthians 14, he's talked about women prophesying.
And so he's talking about that presumably is happening. Prophesying. Exactly.
And, exactly.
I mean, what I've often heard said is this is actually more about, so when I've spoken to Tom Wright about this, for instance, he says, well, this is more likely a cultural issue to do with women because they weren't necessarily taught in the Greek. It was the men who generally were the educated ones, and they were being taught perhaps from the front, and the women who were not able to take part at that point would perhaps be talking amongst themselves. And it's simply about order and saying, please, women, don't you know, disrupt things by talking. And if you need and if you haven't been able to understand the message, please then make sure your husband explains it to you if they're the one. And so it's a kind of for someone like Tom Wright and Paula Gooder and Lucy Papiat, I imagine it is very much a cultural command in a very specific context, which was right for them, but is not some kind of general. I don't know if that's the way you see it, Rachel, or whether that's you do think there is actually it applies more specifically generally to church contexts.
I do believe that Paul in 1 Corinthians is talking about a particular issue in the Corinthian church, and he's dealing with an issue of order about, and you know, Paul in many places, but wants things done in good order. He wants things done decently that doesn't bring disrespect on the church. And so there's something that he's dealing with that's a particular issue at that time. I think that it is remarkable in that passage, and it often gets overlooked, that Paul is calling for women to learn and be taught, because women weren't taught theology. They weren't supposed to sit and learn theology. And so that is, you know, it's worth noting that Paul says that they should be taught. The 1 Corinthian passage, I think, is a more difficult passage in general to know everything that's going on. You know, he's talking about head coverings here. He's talking about this there. It's hard. It's a difficult passage to know exactly everything that's going on. I think the 1 Timothy passage is where it's more clear. I think it's where I would go first when I'm talking about this as an issue. I wouldn't start with 1 Corinthians as a proof text for ordination and for a woman's role in the church.
Quick response, Beth, and then we'll go to our break, and perhaps we'll have time to talk about the family side of this as well.
Sure. So I would argue that none of those are general calls for women, because as Rachel rightly pointed out, that we see women doing all of these things. And so it simply cannot be. And we also see Paul working with women and calling women out as teachers and apostles. And so I would say that so if we start from that premise, then we have to read those passages differently. And it's not because we're doing strange things to the text or we're doing gymnastics to the text. In fact, I would say that you have to do more gymnastics to the text to argue that women are limited in roles, because women do all those roles in the early church. So I would argue that, you know, in some ways we're starting from the wrong premise. And so what we have to do is we think about what Paul's doing, and Paul's writing letters to churches that are having problems. And like in Ephesus, we know that part of the problem is the cultural influence of the cult there, and the roles that women and men had in that, and what they were bringing into the church. And Paul's essentially saying, "Don't do that. That's not what we're doing here." He does the same thing in Corinthians. He says, "Y'all are doing things that you do in Corinth. Don't do them in the church." And so I actually think Paul's message is consistent. I write in my book that we have made Paul inconsistent because we have tried to apply, we have taken order and we have turned it into hierarchy. And I would actually argue, this would be one point where I think probably Rachel and I would disagree, I would argue that you cannot argue that women cannot be leaders in the church without implying a hierarchy that is rooted in nature. So I would argue that there is something, when you say that there is something about a man that makes a man able to lead and a woman cannot because she is a woman, I would argue that that is a difference of nature, and I would argue that that is not biblical. So...
Well, maybe we can chase that up in the next section. We're talking about biblical womanhood on the show today. A lot of agreement between my guests in the first section of the show. More disagreement in this latter section. Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller are joining me with their different perspectives. And we'll be back to continue the conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. We'll be returning to our discussion on biblical womanhood in just a moment's time. And we'll be letting you know how to get in touch with the show a little bit later on if you'd like to respond to anything that the guests have been saying on today's show. And we'll hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Later on tonight, here on Premier Christian Radio, on The Profile at 8 p.m, Sam Hales talks to Marvin Rees, the mayor of Bristol. He's a black Christian who was involved in managing the race protest last year that saw a statue of slave trader Edward Colston torn down and thrown into the Tyne. So that'll be a very interesting conversation, I imagine, with Marvin Rees. That's also available on The Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. Next week here on Unbelievable, what does science and scripture tell us about the first man and woman? William Lane Craig's new book is In Quest of the Historical Adam, and it's a biblical and scientific exploration of how Christians should understand the Adam and Eve story. Well, I'll be joined again by computational biologist Joshua Swamidas, author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve, along with Bill, for a discussion on that. Should be a really interesting one, looking at the case for the historical Adam and Eve next week on Unbelievable, here on Premier Christian Radio at 6 p.m. on the Saturday, on your podcast if you listen to us via podcast, and some other really exciting shows to come in August as well, which I'll tell you about a bit later on. For now, let's get back into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Really good discussion today on Unbelievable between Beth Allison Barr and Rachel Green Miller. Beth with a more egalitarian, to use the label, sort of perspective on the roles of men and women in church and family, and Rachel with a more complementarian, though again with caveats, as because you get your soft and your hard complementarians. In fact, I just recently had a show with, I don't know if either you are familiar with Jackie Hill Perry, and she's very interesting sort of author, speaker, hip-hop artist, but she described herself as a soft complementarian, because she said she does believe in the sort of the family-ish thing, but she teaches Bible in church. And so there are lots of different ways in which, you know, people hold these kind of perspectives, aren't there? Now, just wanted to get back to what Beth said just at the end of that last section, Rachel, which is she does think ultimately that if there is this different, if there is an issue that it's only even qualified men who are eligible for ordination in the church, ultimately that is a hierarchy, and that does ultimately come down to an ontology, the nature of a man versus a woman. Any response to that? I didn't want to leave that unchallenged, and so feel free.
Other than to say that when we're talking about the ordained leadership of the church being such a small percentage, right? So that the majority of people in the church are men and women who are submitting to the authority of the church. Men and women are in submission to the local authority of the church leaders. Then I can't see it as a nature of man if men are submitting to men just like the women are being called to. I mean, I understand Beth's point. It's one of those places where we're just going to fundamentally disagree. And I'm okay with that we disagree. I don't see it as hierarchy. I see it as an order, and I don't see it as an issue of nature of men and women. That there's not something that is inherent in man.
This has been somewhere where you've been particularly aware of, in the complementarian movement, there even being a move to suggest a hierarchy in the Trinity that sort of somehow, right, then is reflected into this hierarchy between men and women. And you think that's a very dangerous sort of way, type of theology to try and, right, use to justify this kind of hierarchy. Do you want to just explain that? Because I hadn't really come across this before I started engaging with your work, Rachel, on this. So just explain what this idea is.
The idea, it's called the eternal subordination of the Son, or eternal submission of the Son, eternal functional subordination, eternal functional submission, eternal relations of authority and submission. So you get ESS, EFS, and ERAS, and while there is intramural discussion, they're all the same thing.
All of the acronyms there, yes.
Right, all of the acronyms, they all boil down to the same thing, which is a belief that within the Trinity, within the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, that the Son, the second person of the Trinity, is eternally in a role of submission to the Father. That for all time, for all eternity, the Son submits to the Father. And so then when Jesus is incarnate, when does his role of mediation, his work of mediation in the redemption work here on earth, that he is still submitting to the Father because that's what he does. Right? The problem with it when you're dealing with pre-incarnation within the Godhead, so you have the Father, Son, and Spirit, all Father, Son, and Spirit are God, right? So God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit. There is one divine will. There is one divine nature. So to say that the Son is submitting to the Father, he's submitting with what? He doesn't have a separate will. He doesn't have a separate nature. He is God. He's divine. When you talk about Jesus incarnate, so he is the God-man. He is has both divine nature and a human nature. As human, as the man Jesus, he submitted to the work that the Father had for him. Right? That is limited to his role as mediator. And classically, throughout Orthodox Church history, that has been the understanding of these roles. If you look at all things prior to 1970, this is the way it's talked about. And it's not egalitarian to point this out. This is classic Orthodox Trinitarian thought. Starting with a handful of guys in the 70s and 80s, you see it in the CBMW in Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, they begin to use this idea of submission. So what they're trying to get to with submission in the Trinity is that if there can be equality in being, so that God the Father, God the Son are equal in being, but their hierarchy in their roles, then you can get around the problems of saying that men being in charge and women submitting to that is hierarchy. And you can say, no, what you're really just doing is they're equal, but they have different roles. And so it's an attempt to ground their understanding of men and women in the nature of the Trinity. But in doing so, they do damage to the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity. And the thing that Beth pointed out in her book and talking about Arianism is this goes back to a heresy from early church history and looking at the 300s, 400s, with Arius, who believed that Jesus, that the Son, God the Son, was a created being. So the Arians taught really two things. One, that the Son was created, and two, that he was subordinate to the Father. With the modern ESS debates, it's not Arianism classically because they don't believe and they're not teaching that the Son was created, but they are still teaching that the Son was subordinate, and they're using the same arguments in the same ways that the Arians used. So it's a fair thing to say that they are relying on Arian arguments, but it is having to parse that they are not traditionally Arian.
But nevertheless, you would regard it as a heresy. Yeah, I was going to say,
yes.
As far as you're concerned.
Yeah, it's a first-year doctrine. Yeah. You're getting the Trinity wrong. It's a big
well,
deal.
That's very interesting. A bit of a departure from the subject to some extent, but nonetheless relevant, and especially when it comes to the issue of submission, because that's, as you say, often the way these things are framed. Now, there is, we haven't covered one particular famous passage that does talk about submission, And maybe this is where we can have a little conversation before we have to wrap up the show, because this is it, when it comes to male headship and that sort of thing. I'm going to read from Ephesians 5, 21 to 27. This is and this is in the NIV, is headlined Instructions for Christian Households. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Saviour. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Okay, let's start with you, Beth, on this one. So you don't believe in the concept of male headship, but obviously No. A lot of people read that verse and say, well, mm-hmm. Husband is to be the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Wives must submit to their husbands in like manner. So where do you go with that reading, Beth?
Yeah, no, again, historical context. I love what Ben Witherington says, where he says a text without a context is a pretext to say whatever you want. And I just think I'm a historian, so history matters. But I think about if we put that in the context of the Greco-Roman household codes, what we see here is, Paul is teaching the early Christians to walk a difficult line. They need to obey the authority of the Roman Empire. They're already suspect because they are from the Judeo, tradition. And if we think about the first century, I've been teaching this in Sunday school. You think about the first century, trouble's bubbling for them. But getting to the 60s and the 70s, trouble is coming in the Roman Empire. So, I think Paul here is being, he's saying we've gotta live the way that we're supposed to live. This is what the world around us says to do, but we're going to do it the Jesus way. I really like, and I know a lot of people react negatively to Rachel Held Evans, but she was just spot on when she did this. This was the first thing that I remember reading from her, and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is something that I've been reading from scholarship and from all of the stuff I do, and then here's someone who isn't. Who hasn't been trained or doing anything, and she saw right through it. And so she calls it a Jesus remix, that Paul's doing a Jesus remix. And the scholarship shows us that clearly seems to be what Paul is doing. The Roman law, although things didn't always live out this way, but the Roman law was that husbands had the right of life and death over their wives. And so here we have, it says wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. I love that part because it makes it clear that what you're submit, it's the Lord here that you're submitting to. And we have to remember the verse right before it that says that we are to submit to each other, that we are called to submit to each other. So it's funny, then right after it says wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. And then it says husbands, love your wives as Christ loves the church. And essentially he's turning it topsy-turvy. You may have authority over the life of your wife in the Roman world, but in the world of Jesus, you give up your life for your wife. And I think Paul, and it's also remarkable that Paul starts with the woman here. That's also, if you look at the Greco-Roman household codes, they're written to men, by men, for men. And it's here we see in these in the first century household code, they're written to all the people. Everyone's here in the conversation. Lucy Pepiot talks about this. So I just don't see, I think Paul is telling them how to live in their world, but to do it the Jesus way. And so I just don't see this as a call that wives are to be under the authority of their husbands. I think Paul's flipping the narrative.
So in the sense then, Beth, just as the commands to slaves, obey your masters, because yep. But to do it as you would serve the Lord and so on, just as that doesn't really have much relevance to us today because we no longer have that culture in the 21st century Western world, likewise we shouldn't necessarily import specific commands to help Christians live in that patriarchal culture that was the default into our modern culture in that sense.
No, I think we take
the point. Yeah,
that's exactly. I think we take the, we submit to each other. That's the overarching principle of this passage is that we are to live in unity in Christ.
That's an interesting perspective there, Rach. Do you think these household codes are still, in a sense, relevant to, you know, people today, that actually we should read something specifically for men and women, wives and husbands in this particular context?
I do believe that there is an application for us today. I do believe that Paul is calling husbands to a servant leadership and calling wives to a voluntary submission to that leadership. I do agree that you do have to look at it in context. I believe that Paul is turning the traditional household,
code.
Upside down, right? He is emphasizing things. I really liked Cynthia Westfall's work in Paul and Gender on this, when she points out that he is calling husbands to do work that only servants would do. Like when the washing, the cleaning, the things that are beneath them as men in the Roman world. And he's calling them to this kind of service to their wives. And I think that's very important in how Paul is describing it. I agree that verse 21 in the submit to each other as unto the Lord, you know, all of that is the heart of the whole passage. I do think that there are specifics. You see it for what the husband's called to, what the wife is called to. You see it in children and parents, that there are some specifics in the relationship. I think it's defined by the relationship, which is where, again, I'm not talking about submission as something that only women do, or, you know, leadership is something only men do. I think it's a function of the marriage relationship. One of the things I point out, that I think that submission for a wife is not subordinating her to her husband, not making her less than or inferior to her husband. I think it is a voluntary submission of an equal, something that she does out of respect for her husband, in recognition to her ultimate Lord, who is Christ, and that her husband is leading in service as he takes care of her and the family, as the example of Christ in the church. And I like Stephen Tracy has a quote that I like. He talks about it as a voluntary yielding to another in love. I think that's the focus, the emphasis of the passage is how we are caring for each other, how we are serving each other, even though there are some specifics to the relationship, depending on if you're talking to husband or wife, parents or children.
Mm. Obviously, we're not going to, you know, hash this out fully in today's program. We're already approaching the end of the show, but it's been a really interesting conversation. Love the fact that while you do hold different perspectives on ordination and male headship in the family and that sort of thing, nonetheless, there's been such a lot of commonality and grace and goodwill between you both, and that's the way it should be. Do go and read both books. Can I encourage you as well to go and visit Beth's website, bethallisonbarr.com, and find out more about The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And also rachelgreenmiller.com to find out more about her book, which is Beyond Authority and Submission, Women and Men in Marriage, Church and Society. Thank you so much, Rachel and Beth, for being on the show today. Any final thoughts as we just wrap up today's show? I'll start with you, Beth, and then Rachel.
Well, I think the important thing about this is that while I would argue that there is not that biblical womanhood isn't biblical, I think what's even more important than that argument is that this is not part of the gospel, and that whatever you land on that people who hold an opposite view can still be faithful Christians. And so I think that's the most important thing that I would like people to hear, and that's why it's the subtitle of my book, that this, the subjugation of women became gospel truth.
And you've already sort of echoed that, Rachel, saying this is ultimately a second tier issue as far as you're concerned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's important for us to be able to discuss these issues. I think it helps us understand and sharpen our own understanding, and to learn to appreciate another perspective on the same passages. And I think we should be able to do it with less suspicion and less name-calling, which is sadly where a lot of these discussions end up.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you both on the show today. Again, I'll make sure there are links from today's show to both of your websites and the books. But for now, Rachel and Beth, thanks for being with me on today's edition of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really hope you enjoyed listening to today's show. Don't forget you can get in touch with the program with your thoughts by emailing me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also send in your thoughts on our social media at UnbelievableJB for Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is our Facebook page. You can reach me as well on my Instagram and TikTok. That's Justin.Brierley for both of those. And we'll see what you had to say about some of our recent shows in just a moment's time. I've got some really interesting stuff going out on our blogs and on articles as well. Recently published on Premier Christianity magazine, an article from Luke Barnes, the Christian astrophysicist who joined us for one of our episodes of The Big Conversation, debating the fine-tuning of the universe. Well, in this article, he explains why he's no longer a young Earth creationist. And not many people know that about Luke, that he started out as a young Earth creationist. And he explains how he changed his mind on the age of the universe. I'll just read you the opening paragraphs of this article for Premier Christianity magazine. Luke writes, "In early 2002, I caught the train to a small office building in Sydney. I was 18 and starting an undergraduate degree in physics at the University of Sydney. I'd sent an email to a well-known young Earth creation ministry explaining that I was going to talk to a professor about a first-year research project on Big Bang cosmology. Did they have any resources that would help me defend a 6,000-year-old universe? At their office, an enthusiastic lady handed me a large folder. 'We were so excited by your email,' she said. 'Someone who has my eternal gratitude had painstakingly photocopied every article and book chapter that they could find that debunked the Big Bang theory.' I said thank you, squeezed it into my backpack, and walked back to the station. On the train, I started reading. A few weeks later, I went to see the professor." Find out what happened when he did. It's a great article written by Luke there. And whatever your views are on young Earth creation, I think you'll find it an interesting one. And who knows, maybe we'll get Luke back on the show at some point to talk it through with a young Earth creationist as well. But again, you can read the rest of that article. So it's been posted to our Facebook and Twitter account. It's over at premierchristianity.com. It'll be coming out in our next newsletter as well. And if you want to get yourself subscribed to the newsletter and receive all the latest stuff from Unbelievable, just go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on newsletter. You can get yourself subscribed there. The link is with today's show on the podcast as well. Let's go to some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. Thanks to those who got in touch about the Jackie Hill Perry live stream that we broadcast last week. Lots of positivity around that. Though fully vaxxed Prairie Sunflower tweeted, "I think God is big enough to accept and love LGBTQ people. After all, he made them." And I suspect that's in response to the fact that Jackie Hill Perry obviously decided to renounce that kind of identity when she became a Christian. This one, though, from Gramingo, a few responses here on the YouTube. "Wow, oh wow. I love Jackie Hill Perry. Some friends and I just finished her wonderful Bible study on Jude. Amazing. Highly recommend. I do listen to Jackie and her husband Preston whenever possible. Thanks for the interview, Justin." And Jeff said, "Jackie Hill Perry and her husband Preston, such a huge gift and wonderful biblical influence in the broader Christian culture today. Truly brings so many together. Thank God for them. Pray their testimony will continue to make an impact for the gospel." And Michael said, "Justin, first, great interview. Appreciate your work. I do believe, though," and this is responding to our brief conversation on racism, CRT and that kind of thing that I had with Jackie. Says, "I believe it's true that episodic racism happens, but I don't believe it's systematic. I don't see it, nor do I think anyone would overtly permit it. We all work very hard to be image bearers of God. And even in our society, we have programs and policies and people who work to correct racial issues. We should all keep working on it, but it will always be a problem." I mean, that whole issue of systemic racism, CRT, I think we will return to that in due course. It's been nearly a year since we first started broadcasting some shows responding to that on Unbelievable. And it obviously continues to be a very hot potato. But yeah, we'll see if we can do something again in the not too distant future around those issues. Speaking of some of the issues that were raised in the Jackie Hill Perry interview, one issue was transgender that she was asked questions on by the watching audience and responded to. And I've had this in the kitty for a while, this interesting email from Mary in Canada. And this is responding actually to a show from earlier in the year when I had Preston Sprinkle on in conversation with a transgender priest. And this is what Mary said. My husband and I never miss an episode, often share the Unbelievable podcast with friends here in Canada. We don't always listen in order, though, which is why I'm a bit late responding to that conversation between Christina Beardsley and Preston Sprinkle on transgender. I enjoyed the feedback and that as much as the conversation prompted me to send this message. The topics caught my attention, particularly as three of our kids are teenagers, and the presence of LGBTQ issues is very real for their generation. For example, our 13-year-old was recently called a homophobe, which he isn't, because he said he wouldn't date a trans woman, more so than it was for ours anyway. As a result, we've had to consider very carefully our position as Christians with regard to this community, knowing that if kids spout religious-sounding ideology that they have picked up at home or church, it can be damaging for them and for others. Also, as a home church, we've deliberately reached out in active engagement with a local transgender support group, building friendship and a positive connection through which we hope to learn and grow as people who practice love. So, to the point, we are part of the Meeting House family in Canada. Now, I know the Meeting House, Mary, quite well, because Bruxy Cavey is a friend and has been on the show a couple of times. But you say we're part of the Meeting House family, deeply appreciate the careful path our leaders have carved that rests on the idea of acceptance without agreement. Acceptance is unconditional, without judgment, and does not imply agreement with and approval of, even if agreement would be a more comfortable place to land. In the conversation between your guests, it seemed to me that this principle was very much at work in Preston Sprinkle's approach to the transgender community. He was careful and thoughtful in what he said and projected genuine acceptance of Christina while standing firmly by his position. Conversely, I found it interesting that for Christina, the principle of acceptance seemed to be conditional upon affirmation. She mentioned that safe churches for transgender people must be both accepting and affirming. I find this to be quite a dangerous premise. I found increasingly that people interpret disagreement as rejection, which is so sad. Genuine debate and sharing of ideas is stifled by our prevailing need for politically correct language and opinion and general affirmation of whatever someone's truth happens to be. I think you touched on this when you moderated a discussion about cancel culture. I do understand that as a marginalized community, there is a reasonable habit of defense, but much is lost when the principle of acceptance without agreement is rejected. Another issue for me, and I recognize this is a little more charged and a lot less okay by current standards, is that as a woman, I struggle to accept that a man can identify as a woman having had no authentic experience, biologically, socially, psychologically, of being a woman. The lived experience of womanhood is closely bound to our biology and thousands of years of living under patriarchy. I accept that those who identify as transgender do not feel as though their cognitive self is concordant with their physical self, but I can't understand how they can then appropriate a different gender to assuage those feelings. If I, as a Caucasian woman, chose to identify as Indigenous Canadian, there would be, and has been, uproar. Cultural appropriation is definitely not permitted. How then can we give the nod to gender appropriation? I would have been interested to hear how Christina and Preston might have hashed out those two thoughts. Thank you very much for that very interesting email, Mary, over in Canada. And one that's, you know, constantly comes up again and again. Obviously, you've had J.K. Rowling making further statements around transgender issues as someone who I think was very much in accord with your feeling there, that while she doesn't deny the rights of transgender people to dress and express themselves in whatever way, that shouldn't trump, if you like, the rights of women to say no, there is a biological connection to the experience of being a woman. And likewise, obviously, with the Olympics going on, there's, as you would expect, controversies surrounding, you know, weightlifting events where transgender women are taking part and so on. But in any case, these things rumble on, and I'm sure, again, we will cover some of these issues in future shows. It'll be very difficult to avoid them, I imagine. Anyway, good to have all of that feedback, all of that interesting response to recent editions of the show. Thank you so much for being with us on today's edition of the programme. And we've got plenty more good stuff coming over the rest of the summer into August. Let me tell you what's coming up on the show next week. The historical Adam and Eve is our subject. I'm going to be joined by William Lane Craig. He's got a new book out. It's a big one. In Quest of the Historical Adam is a biblical and scientific exploration of how Christians should understand the origin story in Genesis. And he'll be joined by computational biologist Joshua Swamidas, who's author of The Genealogical Adam and Eve. Really interesting discussion for you next week on Unbelievable. Hope you can be with us for that. Until then, have a good week.